I want you to think about an iconic chef. Someone who's truly changed the food industry, and really, the way people eat. Do you have someone in mind? I'm willing to bet that some of you pictured Chef Jacques Pepin. Now, before you get super excited, I don't actually have Jacques Pepin on my show today. One day, I hope. However, I do have Chef Raleigh Wiesen, who's the executive director of the Jacques Pepin Foundation, as well as an assistant professor at Johnson & Wales University in Providence, my alma mater. Today, you'll hear the story of how the Jacques Pepin Foundation came to be and learn about their mission. And this whole conversation centers around food education, something I always enjoy talking about. This is Chris Speer, and you're listening to Chefs Without Restaurants, the show where I speak with culinary entrepreneurs and people working in the food and beverage industry outside of a traditional restaurant setting. I have 31 years of working in kitchens, but not restaurants, and currently operate a personal chef business throwing dinner parties in the Washington, D.C. area. Why does everyone know the name James Beard? Sure, there were the books, columns, and television appearances, and I don't want to downplay that, but there were a lot of great people in the culinary world. I'd bet that most people today know the name because of the James Beard Foundation and the awards that have become the standard of culinary excellence in this country. So what does that have to do with Jacques Pepin and today's guest? Well, today's conversation is with Chef Raleigh Wiesen. Raleigh's actually married to Claudine Pepin, Jacques' daughter. In talking with Jacques, they thought it would be a great idea to start a foundation while he's still alive and create something that would have a lasting, positive effect on the world. Jacques decided that he wanted the foundation to focus on one singular mission: to support community kitchens that offer free life skills and culinary training to adults with high barriers to employment. Those barriers could be previous incarceration, homelessness, substance abuse issues, low skill, or lack of work history. So on this episode, we talk about how the foundation actually came to be and have a more in-depth conversation about their mission and what the future holds for the foundation. Raleigh also shares some fun stories like the photographing of Jacques' cookbooks. And being a professor at Johnson & Wales, we spoke about the state of culinary education today. Towards the end of our discussion, Raleigh and I spoke about what good food is, seasonal cooking, and having family meals at home. I thought it was a great side conversation, but it didn't really fit here. I'm actually going to release it as a mini episode in the next couple of weeks, so be on the lookout for that. As always, if you'd like to learn more about Chefs Without Restaurants, you can go to chefswithoutrestaurants.org. From there, you'll find links to things like our email newsletter, my Instagram page, which is at Chefs Without Restaurants, and our private Facebook group for culinary entrepreneurs. If you love this show, please share it with people on social media, or maybe just bring it up in casual conversation at your next dinner party or when you're talking to other parents at the bus stop. So this week's episode will be coming right up. Are you a personal chef looking for support and growth opportunities? Look no further than the United States Personal Chef Association. With nearly 1,000 members across the U.S. and Canada, USPCA provides liability insurance, certification, lead generation, and more. Consumers can trust that their meal experience is insured and supported by USPCA. And now, for a limited time, save $75 on new membership and get your premier listing on Hire a Chef by using the code TAXBREAK2023 at USPCA.com. That's capital T, capital B. Plus, if you have products or services to sell chefs and their clients, showcase your business on Hire a Chef and USPCA websites with our great introductory packages. To learn more about membership, advertising, or partnership opportunities, call Angela at 1-800-995-2138, extension 705, or email aprather@uspca.com. Hey, Raleigh, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
I'm excited to talk to you today. You might be a little biased, so I think I can say this, but I don't think there's a living chef more revered than Jacques Pepin. Wouldn't you agree?
I do actually think that also. I think of him as certainly the greatest culinary educator of our time. It's also hard to compete with, 32 published cookbooks and hundreds of hours of television. I mean, he really set the stage for lots of us. I think he's pretty accomplished. He's got a lot to be proud of.
And I want to talk a little bit later about the endurance of that, because there's a lot of people who cook and have put out cookbooks, but to kind of persist for so long, I think, is impressive. But you're the executive director of the Jacques Pepin Foundation. And also, you're a professor at Johnson & Wales, the school that I went to, too. So we have a little connection there. I
love to talk about Johnson & Wales, and we'll maybe get into that a little bit. So it sounds like we're going to be talking about culinary education today.
Yeah, sounds great. I mean, it's very important to me, both for in both of my jobs, both as a professor at Johnson & Wales and as the director of the foundation. I mean, we really believe in the value and the power of culinary education. It has the potential to help people get jobs, help them to eat better, help them to eat more nutritiously, help them to take care of themselves and take care of their family. I mean, learning how to cook, I think, is truly an essential skill and something that's at risk. I mean, when we look at where we are in society today, we're not teaching people how to cook in school. Lots of people, they're we can't learn how to cook from their parents because their parents don't know how to cook. You know, we've really become a kind of a grab and go convenience food society. And it worries me that we're maybe only one generation away from losing these skills. So I definitely want to be part of the movement that keeps cooking alive.
Me too. I mean, I'm a personal chef and I go into people's homes all the time and I do dinner parties and, you know, sometimes it's fancy, but a lot of the stuff I do, I don't feel is out of the reach of a normal person. And people are so surprised and they say, well, you know, how do you make this? And I'll say, well, I don't have a recipe. Just, you know, listen, I'll kind of talk you through it. And people have trouble following along, you know, and I have a friend who has an oil and vinegar shop and she sells dozens of them. And people come in and say, like, I don't know what I'd do. What would I do with a peach vinegar? What would I do with a Meyer lemon oil? And like, to me, it seems so basic. Like, what do you mean? Like, make a vinaigrette and instead of using apple cider vinegar, put peach vinegar in. But it just seems like it's so out there for people who aren't used to cooking.
Yeah, for sure. And we really try to stress, especially, you know, taking the ethos from Jacques, we try to stress the importance of technique and understanding, you know, that there are some fundamental techniques and some fundamental understandings that go into being a good cook. And once you have command of a few of them, you can really do a lot of things. We actually, 2 years ago during the pandemic, we built out a course with Ruby.com, which is Ruxbe.com. And I'm not promoting it, but what's really interesting about the course is that we started with ingredient profiles. So, for example, there's a whole lesson on leafy greens and tender vegetables. And we use that as a starting point to say, like, okay, here's all the different ways that you can actually cook leafy greens and tender vegetables. You can steam them. You can saute them. You know, you can sweat them, and here are all the things that can come out of it in the end. So it's, I really feel like there's an understanding that comes from having a repertoire that's organized around sets of ingredients, sets of skills, and breaking free of the recipe. I think it's important to follow the recipe as you're learning how to cook. It's important to follow the recipe if you're cooking out of your comfort zone. That is, if it's Moroccan food and you want to learn how to make Moroccan food, follow the recipe the first time. Don't go off-piste, you know, your very first time through the recipe. But after you've done it a couple of times, you'll get the idea. You can substitute turnips for carrots and substitute this spice for that spice. And that's really how you build up your repertoire and become a good cook, in my opinion.
Well, I used to ask guests on the show what their favorite cookbook is or culinary resource for a number of years. You know, people would just say the Flavor Bible is one of them. And I think that kind of touches on, you know, you've got this ingredient, what goes with it? How do you prepare it? If I've got carrots, you know, here's some synergy here. And then, of course, he literally wrote a book called Complete Techniques. You know? And I think that's one of those like culinary foundation kind of Bibles, especially. There's so many photos in the new Complete Techniques book. You know, it's hard to read about breaking down a chicken if you're going to look at it in a cookbook as opposed to a video and kind of get the feel. So to have a book where you can flip through and not only read about it, but also see a lot of photos in detail about how to do that. So those are two books that have always come up on my podcast as far as like books that chefs love.
Sure. And I won't belabor the story behind that too much, but Complete Techniques is an amalgamation of two books that Jacques wrote way back in the 70s, La Technique and La Méthode. So Complete Techniques is a reissue of those. But the original story behind La Technique was, which was probably the cookbook that launched Jacques' cookbook career, was he was approached by a publisher who said, oh, you know, we think your approach to cooking is really interesting, that you're always focused on technique and you're always showing people how to do it. Would you write a cookbook for us? And he said, sure. And they started down this path. And he said, what's really important to me in this cookbook is we're going to have lots of close-ups and close-ups on my hands, actually doing the skill. So you get to see when he's breaking down a chicken, like here is where you put the knife for all the successive cuts that gets you to a chicken that's broken down into eight parts. And they were like, okay, sure, we'll do that. And, you know, of course, at that time back in the 70s, you know, trying to put photographs into a book was pretty expensive. So they said, well, how many photographs do you think you're going to need? He said, well, probably like 500. And they were like, whoa, well, that's a lot, but okay, we'll go with that. And then he called him back a month later and he said, I think we're going to need like 1,000 photographs. And they were like, okay. And then he called him back a month later. He said, maybe like 3,000 photographs. And they were like, okay, you can have 3,000 photographs, but no more than that. And literally they shot, he and his photographer, Tom Hopkins, literally shot 3,000 photographs for that series of books. So
that's amazing. And now it's, you know, pretty common to have all these cookbooks that have lots of photos, although they're not technique driven. It's, you know, a photo of the dish. But, you know, when I started collecting cookbooks when I was younger, it was just all text and you just kind of, you know, flip through these books and there were no photos. So to see a book like that with so many pictures.
And super interesting we have some professional friends, like, for example, Tom Colicchio and Chris Cosentino, both are two that really stand out in my mind that, you know, were struggling in school and they were trying to teach themselves how to cook. And they discovered La Technique, you know, at the very early beginning of their career. And they said, oh, this is a book that I can really learn from because it's showing me what to do rather than just telling me what to do. And I think both of those chefs, excellent in their own right, credit La Technique as being sort of the book that inspired them to stick with cooking.
I can totally see that. And the interesting thing about technique, though, is you might have even seen this in, you know, working in culinary school. In kitchens, I was seeing a generation of younger cooks come in and they were technique focused, but they were focusing on new and advanced techniques instead of some of the basics. You know, it's like, sure, I want to come in and learn how to start doing fermentation because that's cool and working with koji. Yet if you ask them to roast a chicken or even butcher a chicken, they were having trouble with that. So, you know, it's great to have a resource like that I feel also addresses the basics. Not that there's anything wrong with that advanced stuff. I love that too, but I feel like today, a lot of younger chefs and cooks want to run before they can walk and are really looking at some of the really advanced stuff when they don't have the building blocks there.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. You know, having been at Johnson & Wales for 12 years now, I've definitely seen some cycles. I mean, the year that I was hired at Johnson & Wales, what was our largest year for incoming freshmen. We welcomed 1,250 freshmen at the Providence campus the year that I started. And that was really a magnificently large number. They converted the bookstore and the library into culinary classrooms. It was kind of amazing. But, you know, at that point, which was, you know, right, 2010, whatever, students were really coming with this idea of like, I want to be the next Bobby Flay, right? They were looking like, I want to be on television. That's where I'm headed. And we definitely saw that sort of peak out and then drop off. And I would say now, even though we have less students and that's not only that doesn't really have any reflection on the curriculum or on the content because we're actually in this strange demographic cliff for anybody who's paying attention to higher ed. All of the baby boomers' kids have all graduated from college. So now we have less students available to us to be in college. So we have less students now. But I would say the students that are Johnson Wales now are really there for the right reasons and really working hard to learn how to do things the right way. And they're there because they love cooking and they love making food and they want to make food and they understand that it's a hard job, but they're willing to put in the hard work. And I'm really proud of our student body where they're at right at the moment.
I talk about culinary education all the time, and I want to talk about a lot of that more and later in the show. But what I'll say is, you know, the thing that I didn't realize early enough is I focused too much on grades. You know, I came up at a time in the 80s and 90s where, you know, there's a focus on grades, and I think there's an opportunity to maybe take on some easier stuff. My example is like, I never really liked fish. So you're in a class and it's a group, right? There's four of you and you have to make a fish, a chicken, a beef. It's like, oh, well, do I want to do the fish that I don't know how to do and do poorly? Or do I want to take the chicken where I know I'm going to do okay? And, you know, I think I shorted myself in my education because there are ways to kind of get around that. I had a roommate and I love him, Gary, if you're listening, but he was like book smart and he knew that he could, you know, do really well on the projects, the tests, the quizzes, and like maybe maybe the practical aspect, not so much, and like come out with a great, you know, GPA, but maybe not be a hands-on chef kind of guy. And just like I tell everyone, you get out of it what you put into it, right? You should not be leaving a culinary school like that and not be able to butcher fish. Like it's, you know, like really put 100%. In the work and learn all that stuff. Join the clubs, do whatever.
100%. I absolutely agree with that. And I also think, you know, for, as far as my teaching philosophy is concerned, I work really hard to create what I consider to be a safe environment for the students. Like I hear lots of instructors say, oh, there's no stupid questions in my class. But then I hear them actually like make fun of students when they ask a question that's really not that bright. But I really try to be strict with myself and say, there really are no stupid questions in this class. I want you to feel comfortable asking questions. And the next step after that in a safe environment for the students is to say, challenge yourself. Don't take the easy task. Take the hard task. Take the thing that you don't know how to do. It's school, for Christ's sake. If you screw it up, nobody cares. It doesn't matter. There's nobody that paid $50 for that dish that's going to come complain about it. You totally get it wrong. Well, you're going to learn from that experience. I'm going to help you understand what you did wrong. And you're not going to do that same wrong thing again. You'll do better the next time.
I still say I remember the only thing I missed on my storeroom exam was like horseradish. Like he held it up and I didn't know what it was and I got it wrong. And I think that's probably the only thing I remember like from that exam that he held up because it's the thing I didn't get right. Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea. Going back to the foundation, you know, as well known as I think Chef Pepin obviously is, I don't think everyone realizes that there's a foundation. So I'd like to dig into that a little bit. What's the history? How and when did it start? And more importantly, why start a foundation?
Sure. Well, first, I have an in because I am married to Claudine Pepin. So I am Jacques' son-in-law.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. My wife is my best friend and my partner and my companion, and it's we have had great opportunities and a great life together. We've been married for over 20 years now, but you know, we were thinking about. Well, let me take a step back and say I have had many conversations with Jacques about sort of the history of American cuisine, the history of cooking in America, the history of culinary in the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. You know, he arrived in the United States in 1959, and he always says, and if anybody who's heard him speak, they've heard this line. He says, oh, when I arrived in the United States, the culinary world was very small. I had been here less than 6 months and I had already met Julia Child, James Beard, and Helen McCulley, the trilogy, and Craig Claiborne, the trilogy of good cooking at that time. And that was pretty amazing that you could just arrive in the United States. That would be like the equivalent of like showing up here as an immigrant now and getting to hang out with Thomas Keller and Daniel Boulud and Jose Andreas and being like, okay, I know all the important people. That's all I needed to do. And so the culinary world was really, really small. And when I think about, in particular, those three, right, James Beard, Craig Claiborne, and Julia Child, and conversations that I had with Jacques, you know, James Beard was a decent cook, and he wrote some good, pretty good cookbooks, and he hosted a lot of dinner parties, and he was kind of well known in the West Village, but he was terrible on camera, and he really didn't do all that much to teach all that many people how to cook. So he was solid in the cooking world, but really not all that special. And when you look at the James Beard Foundation, his name is sacrosanct now, right? I mean, James Beard Foundation is huge and important and really the, you know, the arbiter of great food in the United States. They've set themselves up to be, you know, like the Michelin guide of the United States. The James Beard Foundation gives the awards to the best food. So James Beard is more remembered maybe even than he deserved based on what the foundation has done. And then there's Craig Claiborne. Do you know who Craig Claiborne is?
I do.
So that's great. I'm glad to know that. But when I ask my students that, none of them know. And generally, even if you ask people who know something about food, they still don't know who Craig Claiborne is. But Craig Claiborne was the first food editor at the New York Times. And when he took over that role at the New York Times, the food section in the paper was 1/8 of a page in the home and garden section. That was the whole food section. And he grew it from 1/8 of a page to 16-page section on food and dining in the New York Times. and in that process discovered great chefs like Marcella Hazan and Diana Kennedy and a dozen other chefs, and Jacques Pepin in a certain sense, that he discovered, wrote his own cookbooks, made it possible to believe that American cuisine could be as good as European cuisine, you know, embraced Le Pavillon and Pierre Frenet and really had this outsized influence on how Americans eat. He really changed how Americans eat, much more so than James Beard did. But nobody remembers who Craig Claiborne is because nobody has made the effort to, you know, remember him and nurture his legacy and remember all of his writings. So it was really those two and the Julia Child Foundation as well that made me think, like, I am not going to let Jacques be forgotten, right? And you could say like, oh, well, of course he won't be forgotten. He's got 32 cookbooks and he's so famous. But you know what? America's attention span is really, really short. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if there wasn't a foundation and Claudine and myself and our great team at the foundation nurturing and projecting and extending the legacy around Jacques that he could be forgotten in a matter of a couple of short years. And so that was really the genesis of the foundation. That's why we decided, you know what? We need to start this and we want to start it now while you're alive so that you can participate, so that you can tell us what to do, so that we could do the things that you want us to do in the way that you want us to do them. And with this longer term goal of making sure that 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now, you're still not forgotten for the great contribution that you've made to culinary arts in the United States and culinary education.
That's amazing. Because I was going to ask about that, you know, there are a lot of amazing people. And like, what's the difference between the legacy of them? You know, so many people, not just in culinary, but everything, they, whether they're an artist or a musician, they do things and then they just kind of fall off. I have kids, I have twins who are 11, and whatever we're talking about, you can be talking about movies and it's like, who's Steven Spielberg? And you're like, oh my God, like, well, I'm not doing my job. You don't know. Right. But yeah, it's especially as someone who's taught a lot of younger people in the kitchens, you know, I'll have younger cooks come on. And I would reference chefs that I would think, you know, you're a cook, you should know. And I'm just amazed that they they don't know. They're not interested. They're more likely to tell you about someone who's cooking on TikTok than like someone who, you know, was a trailblazer in the industry. And it's, you know, disappointing in some regard. So I'm glad to see that it's living on. So like, what is the foundation doing now?
So at that origin point where sort of Claudine and I decided, you know what, we should really start a foundation in Jacques' name. We were a little nervous, you know, like, as you know, Jacques's a pretty serious guy. I mean, he's fun loving and he's kind and generous. And I always say to anyone who asks, you know, the best thing about Jacques is he is exactly the person that you think he is. The person that you have gotten to know through PBS and through videos and cookbooks is the person that Jacques is. He's kind and he's funny and he's generous and he's smart and he loves a good joke and he's willing to share himself with anybody who asks. And he's probably signed, you know, a couple million autographs in the course of his career. So he is exactly the person that you think he is, which is absolutely terrific. But, you know, when we started the foundation, first we were a little nervous and we said, you know, Jacques, we think we should start a foundation in your name. And the first thing he said was, well, it's about time. You know, all the other chefs have them. Jose Andreas has one. Thomas Keller has one. I guess I should have one too. And we're like, okay, great. So we'll go from here. And then, you know, I went to him and I said, well, you know, what do you want us to do? And I sort of presented him a menu of possibilities. I said, look, we could help, you know, inspire cooking classes in elementary school or in junior high school. We could support culinary programs at the high school level. We could provide scholarships for kids to go to higher ed at Johnson & Wales or CIA and extend their culinary education. Or we could provide advanced scholarships for people who had already graduated and were in industry to go to Europe for a couple of years and finish their training. Or we could help people who have been in jail learn how to cook when they get out so they can get a job. And he said, that's the one. That's what we need to do. We need to help people who need skills to take care of themselves by teaching them how to cook. And at the time, I was already volunteering my time at a local community kitchen. That's our sort of shorthand for a nonprofit-based organization that offers short culinary training programs between 12 and 16 weeks. That's what we call a community kitchen. So I was already volunteering my time at a community kitchen here in Rhode Island. And I said, you know, Jacques, at the Rhode Island Community Food Bank, they've got this program where, you know, they do three cohorts a year of about 10 students. They go through a 12-week program. They learn fundamental skills. And he said, that's great. That's what we should do. You should keep teaching them. And how else could we help them? Can we give them books? Can we give them materials? Can we provide them curriculum? I said, absolutely. We can do all of that. And that's really been our raison d'etre from the beginning, is to think about how can we help people who have barriers to employment learn fundamental cooking skills so that they can get jobs in food service. And the great thing about it is it's this triple win-win-win, because it's a win for the individual who learns skills, who learns how to feed themselves better, who learns how to save money. It's a win for the industry that we love, because food service is desperate for cooks. There's over a million job vacancies in food service right now. And it's a win for society, because here's people that get rejected from everywhere else, but they have the opportunity to take a job in kitchens. I'm sure you saw this when you were working in kitchens. I mean, we're a very welcoming community. When you show up at the back door of a restaurant and you're there on time and you've put the jacket on and your knives are sharp, nobody cares where you came from, who you worship, what color your skin is, whether you had been in jail or not. If you show up and do the work, you're all in. We're family and we're going to work hard together.
But the hard part of that is I've worked for some big companies and they don't see it that way. And that's always been one of my challenges. When you work for, say, a contract company like Sodexo or something like that, if you have on your resume that you were incarcerated, you might not get a call for an interview, you know, or someone shows up to your door and they have no experience except that they went through one of these training programs. I was always an advocate for them, but I feel like it was swimming upstream a little bit with some of that. Or when it came time, you know, I would hire someone and they would get in the door and then there'd be time for a sous chef, which is a managerial position. And when you get to that, it's like, oh, well, the company's requirements are a minimum of an associate's degree in culinary arts. It's like, well, but this guy's been here for 5 years doing the job. He literally can do the job, and getting stonewalled at the corporate level of like our corporate policy is. So I do think there's still some frustrations with some of those things. Yes, our restaurant is open and welcoming, but I do, having been on the corporate kitchen side of things, I still think there's a ways to go with some of that stuff.
Sure, absolutely. There are definitely barriers there. And we always work with our community kitchens in particular. We have a granting program. So we encourage community kitchen partners to apply for a Jacques Pepin Foundation grant. And with that granting opportunity, we don't restrict our funds in any way, but we do have sort of certain expectations that we have about how the program will be run, how you treat your students, how many of your students graduate from the program, how many of your students get placed. We also have one of the qualifiers that we like to stress is employer partners, and how those organizations work to cultivate employer partners. And, you know, there's also some great success stories there. You know, our friend, we have a great friend in Maryland, that at the Maryland Food Bank, Tim Reagan, who said he got a call from a corporate partner who said, I want to hire your entire next cohort, all 12 students. I want to hire all of them. And he was like, oh my God, that's amazing. And why? And what that corporate partner said was, your students are so hungry to work and so willing to work hard that they change the culture in our kitchens. And I want them to inspire the people that are here to see how valuable this job is and to see how much energy and enthusiasm they can put into it.
That's amazing to hear. It must be so rewarding to hear something like that.
It really is.
You know, and I think sometimes the people who have to work harder for it appreciate it more. Again, I have a culinary degree, so, you know, I see it from my side, but having run kitchens, I've had a lot of people come in who have culinary degrees, quite often think themselves better than people, maybe didn't have to work for their, to pay for their degree, their parents did or something. And as opposed to someone who really had to hustle and bust their butt to like do it and like it's life or death to get a job, right? Like so many people are on the, whether it be on the poverty line or they just really need the paycheck, they're going to work for it. And some people, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, if this job doesn't work out, I'll just bounce around and go do something else. And you can see the difference in those people.
Sure. Well, and that speaks a little bit to my history as a chef is, you know, I took a, what seems to be a pretty traditional path. I got a degree in literature and journalism and then needed a job.
Not culinary, huh?
Not culinary, but I needed a job when I got done. And you know, food was something that I always liked. And so I was looking around, trying to find a job. I went to college in Pittsburgh, and so I was looking for a job there, and I got hired by this high-end bakery down in the Strip District. And I had to go in for 3 interviews to convince my hiring manager that I was worth taking a bet on, because I was going to work hard, even though I had no culinary experience whatsoever before. And, you know, from that beginning, I loved being in kitchens, and I loved the energy of working with other people. I loved working with my hands, loved making food, loved all the different kinds of food that I was making, and just took a step-by-step approach. And, you know, a couple of years later, I said, you know what, maybe this is really what I want to do, and really committed to food service as my career.
I think it's really rewarding teaching people. It can sometimes be frustrating if you have people who feel like they're not really giving it their all, but there's nothing like that feeling of like teaching people. It's something I really enjoy doing. These training programs, is there a cost involved? Like if someone is, you know, what does that look like?
They're basically all free. And there are a couple of programs that we know of that charge like sort of a nominal fee for the training. But for the most part, it's the culinary training curriculum, the program is offered for free to people with barriers to employment. So anyone who's been incarcerated or homeless or high poverty, low education attainment, all of those things are qualifiers. And each of the community kitchens, we support a network of like 150 across the country. We've given grants from everywhere from Alaska to Miami-Dade County to San Diego to New Hampshire. You know, they're all over the country, and each one has sort of its own individual personality, as it were. So, for example, the community kitchen in Pittsburgh, which we love, 99% of their students are straight out of federal prison. They're previously incarcerated, and you know, our contract with Americans and with the penal system is that, you know, you did something wrong, you got arrested, you went to jail, you paid your dues, right? After that, you should be welcomed back into society. And, you know, really appreciate their program. And other programs have younger populations, other programs have more immigrant oriented populations. It just varies a lot based on the individual program and where they are and who's in their community.
Are all the grants that the foundation offers for community kitchens, or are there grants for other things besides the kitchens?
Only for culinary education / workforce development. We've tried to keep the mission of the foundation to be really, really narrow, and that's really benefited us quite a lot. You know, there's a phrase in the nonprofit world that's called mission creep, where, you know, you start raising some money and then you're like, and then we could do this and then we could do that and then we could do this other thing. But we've been very, very focused. And I think, I'm very proud of the fact that we've stayed on mission to support culinary education only. And in most cases, it's this workforce development, job training. Occasionally we support things like CCAP, which is a high school level program.
Well, you obviously have to do fundraising. I know some of what you do is there's an online platform that or like a membership, right, that people can join. Can you talk about that a little bit? And I'm assuming that the money, if you're paying for a platform, that money's going back into the foundation to benefit these things. Is that right?
Sure. Yeah. one of the things that we realized that we were really good at was throwing events. So, I mean, everybody in our organization has a hospitality background. So when we first started the foundation back in 2016, 2017, we raised money sort of exclusively through in-person events. So, we still have a big, annual gala. We had our sixth annual gala lit this year. Our seventh will be, April 4th, 2024 in New York City. And, you know, at that big gala, we have, about 250 people, and it's a pretty, high dollar ticket, but we also have, an extraordinary lineup of celebrity chefs. I mean, everybody from Jose Andreas to Andrew Zimmern to Ming Tsai, you know, just, Alon Shio was one of our lead chefs last year. We also have, you know, Esther Choi, great, female chefs, great ethnic chefs. We really try to be provide a diverse experience, but also excellence, right? My marketing director has a phrase that says, we don't put Jacques's name on anything that's not excellent. And we try to maintain that. But those in-person events, they were really our bread and butter all the way up until the pandemic. And then, of course, all events got canceled. And so we had to figure out what to do in order to maintain the foundation. And not only was it hard for us to make revenue, but it was also a very desperate time amongst our partners, the kinds of organizations, the food banks and the community kitchens that we support around the country were desperate through the pandemic because it was just very difficult for them as well. And so it was kind of an interesting progression. You know, Jacques was when the pandemic really hit in March of 2020, Jacques and Claudine were having a conversation and he's like, oh my God, I'm going to be stuck at home for 3 weeks. What am I going to do with myself? Who knew? We thought it was going to be 3 weeks, right? It turned out to be 2 years. And Claudine said, well, you know, why don't you just take some videos on your cell phone of like whatever you're making for dinner? You know, everybody's trying to cook at home. So I'm sure people would be interested to see what you're cooking at home, you know, trying to get through the pandemic. And he was like, oh, okay, I guess I could do that. And he started doing that, again, working with his same longtime photographer friend, Tom Hopkins. And like about a month later, you know, Tom calls me up and he says, you know anything about video editing? And I'm like, well, I know a little bit about video editing, but what are you trying to do? He's like, well, I really think I need to use like two cameras and some better sound for these videos that Jacques is shooting. And I was like, well, I can't do that, but I have team members at the foundation that are really good at that. Maybe you should send us the footage and we'll turn it into videos. He's like, oh, that's great. That's a great idea. Well, from that conversation and from those inauspicious beginnings, we created what we call the Cooking at Home series, and Jacques has done over 300 individual video recipes that he shot in his home kitchen, just, you know, shooting whatever he was making for dinner. And it's been wildly popular and catapulted our followers both on Instagram and on Facebook, you know, by a factor of like six. The foundation went from 35,000 followers to well over 200,000 followers in those 2 years. And his Facebook following went from 300,000 to almost 2 million. So it's pretty amazing. And then while he was doing that, we realized that all of our other chef friends, you know, the Thomas Keller and Daniel Balut and Jose Andreas is the world, they were all cooking at home too. And so I was thinking like, okay, how are we going to make money for the foundation? Well, I asked all of them, would you make a video for us in support of the foundation? Not having any idea how we were going to turn that into money, but said, okay, you know what? Shoot the video and let's see what we get. And we asked 100 chefs and all 100 said yes. So
of course,
suddenly we had all of this content coming in of these little video recipes that everybody was shooting at home and everybody was telling their stories about Jacques, and Thomas Keller did fried clams in his, and he wore a Howard Johnson's hat. And, it was, you know, just really fun, cute stuff like that, that happened, when these chefs started shooting these cooking at home videos. Well, we took all that video content, and as we were scratching our heads trying to figure out how to turn that into some revenue to support the foundation, we hit upon the idea of membership. And so now if you join the Jacques Pepin Foundation as a member, you get access to what now is over 200 video recipes shot by the best of the best chefs across the country in support of the foundation. So that's our carrot for membership. And it's been pretty successful. And it's was successful enough that it generated revenue that allowed us to keep all of our staff all the way through the foundation and to continue our granting program. It was lean those couple of years, but very, very satisfying to hit upon that revenue generator that not only teaches people how to cook, right? If you're a member, you get to watch all these videos, but also the money that you spend to become a member supports culinary education of others.
I mean, he's a natural, right? He has a little experience in front of the camera cooking, right? You know, and I think with the foundation, you know, expressing what the money is going to. I think people are more than willing to support a good cause because, you know, obviously in this day and age, there's a million places you can go for free. You can go on YouTube and watch all this stuff and learn how to cook. You know, why should people be, you know, doing this? But I think coming back to the core of, you know, this isn't a money-making thing to line someone's personal pockets. It's really going to good. And I don't know any industry that does more, I think, than the culinary community. Everyone seems so giving of both time and money and trying to put people in a better spot. And I think it's great to see, you know, a foundation like this is genuinely trying to improve people's lives and make our industry better. So, you know, thank you to you and him and the foundation for all of that.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And it's something that that's another thing that Jacques mentions frequently is chefs and really everybody in the hospitality industry is so generous. I mean, we spend our lives committed to making other people happy with food, making other people happy with service, making other people happy with cocktails. You know, the hospitality industry is about generosity and conviviality and community. And really, you know, if you look at Jacques' career, long before we had the foundation, he would say yes to anybody who came knocking. I mean, if it was St. Jude Hospital or the March of Dimes or the United Way or you know, you name it, if somebody came knocking and they said, hey, would you contribute to our fundraiser or would you show up or would you do this or that for us? Jacques always said yes. He always said yes. And I think that's true of a lot of chefs. If they have the time, they're going to say yes. They're going to show up. They're going to contribute their skills, their celebrity, their food to helping organizations that want to make other people's lives better. And it's just a testament to what we do.
I have a friend here in town. She goes to my church. I actually cooked for her a couple of weeks ago and she knew your wife or like, I guess they grew up and went to school together. I'm not sure whether it was like high school or college or something, but she talked about like, I think there was a fundraiser or something. And like, she's like, oh, my dad's making, you know, cookies or cake or something. And it was just this like big shock that like, you know, Jacques Pepin's making cake for the school, you know, bake sale or something like that. I thought it was really funny because I've known Kim for more than a decade and I had no idea. And we're just, you know, recreationally talking about food and cooking. She's like, oh, I went to school with Claudine back in the day. And yeah, I knew her dad and he would just like make stuff for all these events. And I thought, man, how cool would that be?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't cook as much for those kinds of things now as he used to, but happy to come and do a book signing, happy to do a demonstration. One of the things that's been really heartwarming over the last couple of years is when we have this network of community kitchens that we support, and you know, we very much want to project and show that, you know, Jacques is still in it and is still willing to teach and is still committed to teaching. So we've actually taken him into some of our community kitchen partners and organized classes where he'll teach shoulder to shoulder with the students that are in the program. And then we get to capture all that content, you know, through video production so that we can turn it into lessons that we can then feed back to the community kitchen. So last December, he did a demonstration at Community Servings, which is just outside of Boston. And last August, he did a demonstration at Hot Bread Kitchen, which is in New York. And he has so much fun when he does it. It's really great to see him interacting with the students, and they're so excited to have him there. And you know, those kinds of things. You know, we did a demo a few years ago, back at the beginning of the foundation, and back in 2017, 2018. At the New England Center for Arts and Technology, which is a culinary program also in Boston. And they literally said to us, you know, after Jacques came here, it totally changed the fortunes of our organization. Suddenly we had more donors that were interested in supporting us. We became more visible. Our students were happier. Our employer partners were more interested in the students that were here. And so it really added so much value in with really not all that much effort, and something that we're really proud of that we were able to support in that direct way.
And I think that kind of thing keeps you young, right? You know, like going out and still doing what you love, even if it's infrequently, but, you know, just to stay active. It seems like every time I've seen him, whether it be on TV or something, he seems like he's still very much loving this industry. I got to see him talk in 100%. DC. It was probably 2018 or so. Joe Yonan interviewed him at the Smithsonian, and I got to see him, sign a book, had a picture with him back there. So I feel grateful because it's the only time we had met in person. So I thought that was cool. Looking at culinary education in general, it can be expensive, you know, and for someone who maybe doesn't qualify for one of the grant programs, but also maybe doesn't have the money to go to a top tier culinary school. Do you have any advice for people? You know, let's say you're a high school junior, senior, you want to go on culinary arts, but, you know, maybe don't have $100,000 or a couple $100,000 to go to culinary school. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I would say first, just go and get a job. I mean, especially right now, but it's always been true. If you pick out your favorite restaurant in your town and say, hey, can I work a couple of days a week? And right now, for sure, you'll be able to get a job. And even for students who say, I'm going to go to culinary school, I always ask them, like, have you actually worked in a restaurant? Because the restaurant environment is very, very specific. You know, it's hard, it's hot, it's fast. There's things that can burn you, things that can cut you. It's highly stressful. And it's really not an environment for everyone. I mean, some people really thrive on that and some people do not. And so I always recommend, you know, before somebody signs up for, you know, expensive culinary education, that they go and actually try it out and see what it feels like to work in a restaurant. On the other hand, I would say one of the things that's really terrific about Johnson & Wales right now, especially, is that we've really broadened our understanding of what culinary education is. So, of course, we still teach technical competency. We teach people how to cook. You don't spend 4 years at Johnson & Wales and not know how to cook when you get done. You absolutely do. But in addition, and I'm very excited about this relatively new program that we have a Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Food Systems. And that degree program gives us the opportunity to introduce students to many challenges that we have in the food system, whether that's environmental sustainability or childhood nutrition or food insecurity or, you know, not teaching culinary skills in school, or community gardens, and all of these different areas in which the food system is lacking, or it's not actually clear. You know, most people, it's easy for them to understand the idea of, like, farmer grows food gets harvested, food goes to a processing plant, gets packaged, or goes to the grocery store, chef buys it, it gets cooked, and you eat it, right? That linear approach to the food system, pretty easy to understand. But the fact of the matter is that there's all of these other organizations, there's all of these other forces, whether, you know, from the USDA to the Farm Bill to your local food bank to your local church, all of these different organizations that are also involved in the food system in one way or another. And so what we're doing in a lot of the courses, and in particular, I teach a couple of courses, one called Cultivating Local Food Systems and another called Shaping the Future of Food, where we introduce students to all of these problems that we have, whether that's environmental sustainability or food insecurity, and then get them to think about what the causes of those problems are and to think about what the laws and the food policy is that's in place that affects these problems. And then we actually ask them to go out and volunteer with an organization that's trying to solve the problem that they're most interested in. And once they go out there and they spend 20 hours at a food hub like Farm Fresh Rhode Island or a food bank like the Rhode Island Community Food Bank, they come back and they say, oh my God, I had no idea. First, all the great work that's being done to solve this problem, and all of these amazing people that are working so hard, that are getting up every day and going and committing to making other people's lives better through food, or how complex these problems are and how complex the system is. So we're really, like, starting to graduate students that have a much broader understanding of the food system than just, I'm a chef, I'm going to order food from this purveyor, and then I'm going to cook it, and then I'm going to serve it. Like, okay, that's great. And I love to cook too. And if that's what you want to do, you go for it. I want to come to your restaurant. I think it'll be awesome. But we also find all these students now that not only do they want to cook great food, but they want to make a difference. They want to make a difference in their community. And so we're showing them pathways and opportunities to do that.
And it gives you a much more well-rounded background that I think is important in, you know, whatever industry you're going into. I had Chef Russ Zito on the show past year. He was always one of my favorite instructors. He was actually my culinary advisor for my senior when I had to do my internship. So I wanted to have him on. You know, he posts on his Instagram a lot about his garden, and he talks a lot lovingly about the garden and taking the students out there, which is, you know, so different than my experience that I had 20 years ago. I graduated in 98, and to see, you know, we didn't have the giant, I call it like the spaceship, you know, because you come down the hill now and you see this giant building lit up, and that wasn't even there when I moved out of Rhode Island in 2002 there. But, you know, I even remember when I was in school, so many of the kids at the time went to school just to be a chef. And we had related courses like leadership and business ethics. And I remember kids like complaining about like, I didn't come to culinary school to learn, you know, philosophy and leadership and stuff. But it's so important, especially if you're looking to move up. You know, my assumption is if you're going to a 4-year bachelor's program, you're probably looking to move into an executive chef type level. You absolutely need to know things like business ethics and leadership. Sure. But at the time, so many people griped about that. But now seeing like the wide variety of topics at the school, I think is really interesting. I still don't know that if I today was 18, if I could see spending that much money on a culinary degree, because that's something people still ask. It's like, if you had to go back and do it all over again, would you? It's like, I don't know what my path would be. It's a lot. And I tell people like, it's, you know, if you don't have the money and you're going to be paying it off for a decade, like you really have to think about that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Zito is great. He's a good friend of mine, and he's also heavily involved in this sustainable food systems degree, as I'm sure you guys got to in the podcast. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a hard question, you know, particularly if you don't have a lot of money, there are lots of different ways you can go. First, you can just not go to culinary school at all. And as long as you put yourself in the right environment, you are likely to be able to find a mentor who will teach you and take you under their wing and help you learn what you need to learn and nurture your skill set. And a good mentor will be happy when you when your skills exceed the demands of that place and will be glad to send you along somewhere else. So that's definitely a route. And then there's also, you know, community college where it's hard to kind of stomach the $20,000 that you have to spend to go to Johnson & Wales when you could spend $2,000 to go to a community college. On the other hand, the thing that you get from Johnson & Wales experience is this full sort of like university life experience. It's a residential university. You get to meet lots of other people that and spend time with them that have similar interests as you do. It's in a great environment. I think that the faculty are outstanding. So, you know, again, it really depends on your own personal financial situation. And the fact of the matter is that 90% of the students that go to Johnson & Wales get some sort of tuition remission, some sort of discount from the published price. So, you know, again, I agree with you. If you can't afford it, there's plenty of other ways to get there. But I think it's also a great experience. And it's really amazing to me. Where I teach at all levels. Sometimes I teach freshmen. I often teach juniors and seniors. But it's always amazing to me to see the progression of students and how much they change from, you know, that first freshman fall year where they're like scared of everybody and they've never held a knife before and you're worried that they're going to cut themselves. And then you get all the way to like the senior level and they're, you know, in my conscious cuisine class in the sustainable food systems degree, and they're breaking down a whole pig and they're making like a really awesome plate that has pork 4 different ways on it, complete with like foams and gels and homemade smoked bacon. And, you know, the progression from like that scared little kid 3 years ago to what you're capable of doing now, when I can say you are have all the skills you need to be successful in the restaurant industry, is just magical, you know, and it's great to see.
And you have so many cool experiences. Like one of the things I'll always remember is I was there when they were making the movie Amistad, and we were like, I was in Advanced Buffet Catering with Chef Terranova, and they're like, we worked on that, like stuff that was in a movie that was nominated for Oscars, right? Like they came into our class and we're making these like styrofoam things coated in chaux froid with like crayfish coming out with like all these things nice. I would never get to do. You know, we went to the Strand, like Chris Rock was doing a show and our class was asked to like, you know, do his rider, right? And like, just stuff like that that was really fun. I lived on campus for 4 years. I loved it. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. I love talking to you today.
Yeah, it was really great. I really appreciate you inviting me, Chris. This was fun.
Hopefully, I'll make it up to Johnson & Wales at some point, and maybe we can meet up in person.
That would be terrific. You're always welcome. We have dinner every night.
Love it. Love it. I'll come knock on the door. So thank you to all of our listeners. This has been Chris, as always, with the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast. Thank you so much, and have a great week.
You're still here? The podcast's over. If you are indeed still here, thanks for taking the time to listen to the show. I'd love to direct you to one place, and that's chefswithoutrestaurants.org. From there, you'll be able to join our email newsletter, get connected in our free Facebook group, and join our personal chef, catering, and food truck database so I can help get you more job leads. And you'll also find a link to our sponsor page where you'll find products and services I love. You pay nothing additional to use these links, but I may get a small commission, which helps keep the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast and organization running. You might even get a discount for using some of these links. As always, you can reach out to me on Instagram at Chefs Without Restaurants or send me an email at chefswithoutrestaurants@gmail.com. Thanks so much.